So we know that one of the key elements, one of the key aspects of what it means to be an Orthodox Jew is a belief in not only the Torah, the written Torah, the Torah Shebichsav, and the authority and the eternality of the Torah, but also in the authority of the rabbis. And here, a capital R, at least the Chazal, the historic rabbis, and in the binding nature of rabbinic law. And the truth is, there are many questions one could ask about how exactly rabbinic law gets its authority and the scope of that authority. And when we talk about Torah Shebaal Peh, about the oral Torah, the Rambam explains in his Hakdama to the Mishnayos that oral Torah is made up of a composite of some things which we really call D'oraisa, which have the full authority of D'oraisa, even though they're not written out in the Chumash, and they were either transmitted from Har Sinai directly or derived from the Yigimel Midosh Torah Nedreshes Bahem. And it also includes that which we call the Rabbanan, that which was legislated by the rabbis. So what we need to try to figure out is, first of all, why do we listen to rabbinic instruction? What forces us, what compels us to listen to the dictates of the rabbis? So if I were to throw that question out to you, what would you say? Why should we listen? Okay, so we know that the Chumash itself, we all stood at Har Sinai and we accepted the Torah. What's with the rabbis? Yeah, maybe.
There's a mitzvah to listen to what the rabbis say.
Okay,
I
is there?
I don't remember what pasuk it is, but I know it's in Sefer Devarim.
Okay, so let's start with that. All right, so is there a mitzvah that requires us to listen to the rabbis? So that's one question. Is there a mitzvah? And if so, would that solve all our problems? Or would that create problems? So what kind of problems would it create? Okay, so then as Meir asks, so if there is such a pasuk,
how far do we take this also?
So then, okay, so Levi's out there, Levi and Meir are asking kind of the same question from different vantage points. So Levi's asking it kind of fundamentally, so then what would the scope of such a Torah directive to listen to the rabbis be? And Meir's going from the other direction, saying he's assuming that there is a difference. So what could justify such a difference, if at all, is from the Torah. So all of that is correct and reasonable, or at least justifiable. So let's try to take a step back. So what would the pasuk be? So the Losasser is the most likely. It should emphasize that we'll try to mention today that there are at least two psukim that are relevant. There are a couple of others that are thrown into the conversation too. But there are at least two psukim that are possibly relevant, and we'll try, time permitting, to sketch out what could be the role for each pasuk. But one pasuk is, maybe it's correct that it's in Dvarim, we'll be more specific, it's in Parsha Shoftim, we'll be even more specific than that, it's in the very beginning of Parsha Shoftim, it's at the end of the first Aliyah in Parsha Shoftim, where the Torah tells us, that, give a little more context, the Torah says that there'll be a situation where you will not know how to deal with an instruction from the Torah. It'll happen that you're not going to know how to apply the existing mitzvah in the Torah. And what are you going to do? So you'll get up and you'll ask the authority that will be at that time, whoever it's going to be. And that authority will instruct you. And you should do what that instruction is, v'asisa kasher yerucha. And we're told, lo sasur min adavar, you should not deviate from that which they instruct you, not to the right or to the left. According to the great Maimonidean scholar, the Rambam, right? The Rambam in Hilchus Mamrim, and in the Shurashim and Sefer HaMitzvos. And in the Sefer HaMitzvos, before he starts counting the mitzvos, he has to tell you the rules for counting the mitzvos. So those are the Shurashim. So in the Shurashim and in the Mishneh Torah and Hilchus Mamrim, the Rambam says that this pasuk, Lo Saser, that's what tells us how you know that you have to listen to what the rabbis say, including all the new ideas they come up with, including all the new legislation. So there you have it, binding rabbinic authority because of Lo Saser. And the Ramban takes issue with this. The Ramban, in his commentary on the Sefer HaMitzvos, on the Shurashim, the Ramban has a couple of objections. What are his objections? Or what could the objections be, even if you didn't get a chance to see the Ramban inside? What objections could you raise, Maury?
That would make every mitzvah derabbanan a mitzvah
derisa. Okay, so that's essentially what Meir was asking before, right? Okay. That essentially, aren't you basically telling me that every mitzvah midrabanan then is a mitzvah min haTorah? So
where is the
Ramban? The Ramban is in the Shurashim over there. The Ramban is a commentary on the Rambam. On the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvos, the Ramban is over there. So is that a problem to say fundamentally? Is it so terrible to say that every mitzvah derabanan is a mitzvah deraisa? Ah, okay. So Meir points out, well, we know that la halacha, we treat them differently. Now, the truth is, there's a host of issues here. Some of the issues are less significant. You could say, well, what about counting mitzvos? So there are 613 mitzvos. Should we start counting mitzvos to Rabbanan? The Rambam's whole point in the Shurashim is that he doesn't do that. Doesn't count mitzvos to Rabbanan. And the Rambam of Mishneh Torah is clear that he does see a distinction. But as far as just this question of how we treat them, a rule, let's say there are many examples, but the most prominent is that we have a concept of safek d'araisa l'chumra, safek d'rabbanan l'kula, if we're not sure how to address a certain situation. There's something unclear. It's a suffix. So if it's a matter of Torah law, we have to be machmir. If it's a matter of rabbinic law, we have the right to be maker. So ask the Ramban, what right do you have to distinguish if it all comes from a Torah mitzvah? And in fact, it's not only a mitzvah in the Torah then, it's a prohibition. Right? Lo sasur, you shouldn't deviate. Sounds like it's a lav min haTorah. So what right do you have to distinguish you're dealing with an iser min haTorah? It should be a relatively severe prohibition. Now, there are other questions also. First of all, just is the whole premise justified by the context? And so we know, we live in the United States, where theoretically there is a separation of powers. Right now the separation of powers is being played out. Right now two of the powers are going at each other at the moment. Right, but theoretically we have three distinct branches of government. And two of those are relevant here. We have a legislature and we have a judiciary. And in America they're distinct. The legislature makes the laws. They don't get to tell you what the existing laws mean. The judiciary, they get to tell you what the existing laws mean. They do not get to tell you what they think the law should be. They cannot make new laws. They can only tell you what they think the existing laws mean. At least, in theory, that's the way it's supposed to work. So, in the context of the Torah, what's being described? What kind of authority is being described?
authority?
Well, really, judiciary authority. Right? That you don't know what the Torah means. Ki pali mimcha davar, something that is unclear. So the rabbinic authority of that time is given the power to tell you what it means, and that is binding. But it's not clear from there that there is legislative authority to say, well, the Torah means X, but we think also there should be a rule about Y. That doesn't seem clear at all. So that's another objection one could have to the Rambam. So this is a major machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban. There are a few Gemaras that are relevant also, just to quickly sketch them out. One is Daf Yomi this past week. Is anybody holding in Daf Yomi at the moment? So, okay, I see a few nods. So Yossi, there's a Gemara. What's the Gemara is relevant to this in the recent Daf Yomi? Right, Mary, right, that the Gemara talks about Kavod HaBrios. Right, so the Gemara says that Kavod HaBrios, the Gemara is an exchange over there in Daf Yates, that the Gemara says that Kavod HaBrios, first it says, is Docha Alav Shabbatorah. And then the Gemara responds, how could that be? We just said it's not Docha Alav Shabbatorah, it's a Chal Hashem. And then the Gemara responds, Lo Sasser. And there's a whole back and forth about this, but the Gemara has a phrase there that kol milsa d'rabanan asmachuhu alav d'ol saser. That essentially it's referring to dinim d'rabanan, and it's referring to that through the prism of lo saser. So does that support the Rambam or the Ramban? So why would you say the Rambam?
Sounds like it's a legitimate drasha.
So on the one hand, it sounds like it's associating all of the Rabbanans with Lo Sasser, like the Rambam says. However, the Ramban will say to you, as he does, that no, the Gemara says Nasmachta. Doesn't mean that it's actually coming from there, but that they associate it with Lo Sasser. So the Gemara is a little up for grabs.
Like, what about the point of the Gemara where it's saying, like, it's Doka Lo Sasser Shibatorna?
Right, so the Gemara is going to say that it can't really, so the Ramban will tell you that that's an asmachta, and that it can't really mean that, because an actual osase would not step aside for Kavod HaBrios.
So what's the Gemara saying though?
So what the Gemara is using it as an expression, as a way of saying that this is itself an asmachta kind of language. Now what asmachta means is a whole discussion that we're kind of sidestepping for now. Let's assume, without full justification, that asmachta means that it's not the real intent of a pasuk, but it is kind of an illusion. Illusion with an A, not with an I. So that's kind of a hint rather than the actual intention. So if that's the case, okay, so that's how the Ramban will respond, and that's indeed what he discusses over there. Or there's a Gemara in Maseches Shabbos, and Daf Chav Gimel, where the Gemara talks about the whole idea that there's a bracha recited on Hanukkah candles. And the Gemara asks, what bracha do you recite? Oh, Asher Kidshanu b'mitzvosav v'tzivanu l'hadlik ner shel Hanukkah. God commanded us to light Hanukkah candles. Really? He does? He did? Where? It's in Chumash somewhere? So ask the Gemara, Heichan Sivanu, where is that? And the Gemara has a few answers. Rabbi Nachman says, oh, from Lo Sasser, which sounds like the Rambam. But there's another opinion. Vivya, quotes a pasuk in Ha'azinu, Sha'ala Vicha V'yageidcha. There's an interesting Ritva over there. So there's a little bit of an open question also, maybe up for grabs, what to do with these Gemaras. Okay, so this, just to start off with, is the basic machlokas, what is the source? Is the source the pasuk? Or is it something else? Yeah.
The Ramban would hold if it's not from pasuk, it's from Sfarah.
So now you got a problem. If you don't hold, the question is, who do we want to defend first? Do we want to defend the Rambam, or do we want to defend the Ramban first? So let's first try to defend the Rambam first, because what Mori's getting at is that if once we get to the Ramban, we're going to have bigger questions. Because we know the Ramban was an Orthodox Jew. In fact, he was a rabbi himself who observed rabbinic commandments and had quite a lot to say about them. So why did he feel he had to do that if he did not accept this pasuk as the source? So, but first, let's try to address the Rambam's problems. So, how could you explain why it is that the if it all comes from a pasuk of Lososer, so why should we distinguish? How could we be makel by rabbinic law? So there are...
They're about it built in.
Okay, so one approach is to say that this is an intentional approach that the rabbis built into the system. In Hebrew, we would call this kach tiknu. There is no room left to write anything on the board, and I think it's been this way for a long time. We have to, like, call for a new board. Is this erasable?
No.
No, we even bought a...
Yeah?
You need to write over it and then erase it.
Yeah, does that work?
Yeah.
What did you buy?
Bought like a spray.
Didn't work?
Didn't work.
Try writing over it.
All right, well, we should contact somebody back there. But in any event, okay, so I don't know how much we'll be able to write. But anyway, kach tiknu is the idea here. Okay. That... maybe they set it up this way on purpose. Now, why would they do that? Why would they purposely limit the scope of their own authorities? Yeah, Sam? Nobody could abuse it. What does that mean? So that's a fair concern in general. And there are a lot of concerns that we'll see that are relevant to that. And you have to assume that there are checks and balances or other kinds of limitations on how enactments are made. But I don't know if that necessarily addresses it per se. Yes, so what did you want to say?
Just like the main thing we've been talking about, maybe purposely will limit it to make sure we still have this distinction between
their
mind
and ours. You're starting with the why would they want a distinction?
Okay, so yeah, okay, but you're circling around something that's still true. So let's try to answer that. So I think Yossi's not wrong that it could be that they are looking to make a distinction on purpose. So why would they do that? Yeah.
If there was no distinction, then why didn't God just, like, write it down in the Torah also? I mean, I know the answer to this.
Well, so what would you say the answer to that?
There's a couple. One is that, well, it would be physically impossible for, I guess, Hashem to, within the laws of nature, write down every single situation, every single mitzvah, essentially. Because the point of, I guess... of Durabanan, I guess it's sort of like fill in the gaps, but there are too many gaps for it to be filled, for it to be completely filled in, I guess, without breaking the laws of nature. Like, every single situation, that would be a very long Torah. The other one is that there's another answer to that, whether that Hashem wanted people to have a share in the Torah themselves, to ourselves, because I guess the whole lo b'shamayim he sort of thing. So he intentionally left out certain I guess, commandments or ideas for us to fill in.
So there may be truth to those points, but they don't necessarily explain why there should be a distinction between the two. But there might be something else. It might be a Torah value that we're worried about, or a Torah prohibition that we're worried about.
Paul Tosef.
Right? Isn't there a prohibition in the Torah that we're not supposed to add on to the Torah? Now, this is going to open up a big concern. Right? The fact that the Torah tells us we're not allowed to add on is actually a somewhat mysterious concept. And how we balance Baal Tosef with the existence of rabbinic legislation is a big question. Yeah. And what are the parameters of Baal Tosef is a big question. Maybe Baal Tosef means something completely different. But it's certainly a question that presents itself. If we're adding on mitzvahs to the Torah, does that not raise a concern of Baal Tosef? So the truth is, the Rambam himself in Hilchos Ma'amarim actually addresses this. And this is a part of what's going to really intertwine with this parak. And it's a part of why we want to try to make sure we're well grounded in this issue for Kalabasar. Because the Rambam talks about the existence of rabbinic prohibitions in Hilchos Ma'amarim. So his favorite example is about our parak. He uses the example of chicken and milk. So the rabbis prohibited chicken and milk. And that's within their authority. They have the right to come and add, even though the Torah only prohibited beef and milk, and they came and prohibited chicken also, they're allowed to do that. However, says the Rambam, what are they not allowed to do? That they're not allowed to do is to give you the impression that that is from the Torah itself. If they were to blur the distinction and to make it sound like the Torah prohibited chicken and milk, that would be a problem with Baal Tosef. So, based on that, some of the commentaries suggest, the Lacha Mishnah quotes views like this, that that's why we have rules like Sveika Derabanan Lekula, that we have to be more lenient by Dinim Derabanan, because we have to create this distinction in practice. That we have to show that there's a difference between the Torah law and the rabbinic law, because that's what the Rambam himself is saying is necessary to avoid Baal Tosef. Now, this is a fascinating topic for a lot of reasons. And there's a lot that you could raise once you start going down that path. Just to talk about it for a minute. So, for example, is that, first of all, is it really effective? So, if that's really what we're trying to accomplish, and this is so important to accomplish, is that about just putting up a flag? Or is it about fundamentally we want Torah law to play out differently? You know, there's a story they relate about Reb Chaim Brisker, that there was a community in Europe that it was approaching Pesach time and there was a shortage of food. And in this community in Europe, they had very little food. And a lot of what they had was kidneys. And so they asked Reb Chaim Brisker, should they observe the Ashkenazi minig to abstain from kitnios during that Pesach as well. And reportedly, Reb Chaim told them that they should not abstain from kitnios under those circumstances, because he said not only are they permitted to violate this minig in that situation, but he said there's a different concern, that if they were to treat this minig with the severity of a din min haTorah, that would actually violate Baal Tosef based on the Rambam. So it's an interesting question just to what extent this is effective, because on the one hand, we should maybe worry, because if it's so important that we differentiate, that we know the difference between mitzvahs d'oraisa and mitzvahs d'rabbanan, so maybe we're in a shtickl trouble, because nowadays there's a lot we're not sure about. Right? Very often there are machlokas and we seem to be open to discussion, and there's some entire svarim that are written just to try to clarify what's d'oraisa and what's d'rabbanan. On the other hand, it's interesting just to see how it plays out, because if you're going to have a serious halachic discussion about just about anything, certainly in Hilchos Shabbos or in Hilchos Kashrus, the first step is almost always going to have to be, let's figure out, is it a d'oraisa or a d'rabbanan? Because it always impacts the decision. So the fact that we say safek d'oraisa l'chumra, safek d'rabbanan l'kula, the fact that it impacts the halacha, so it means that you have to always try to remember whether something is d'oraisa or d'rabbanan. So that's interesting. It does have that kind of ripple effect. Now, l'maisa, the Ravid didn't accept this Rambam. The Ravid said, what's he talking about? And he doesn't think that that's going to be a violation of Baal Tosef. Baal Tosef means something else. And he says, if the rabbis incorporate something new, it's part of Torah, and that's not Baal Tosef. So Or Sameach, or Meir Simcha, he said he thinks the Ravid has to be right about this. So otherwise, we got a big problem. So if you learn Shas, so you learn, go to Yeshiva, or you learn Daf Yomi. So you read a Mishnah, you read a Gemara. You've got a span of a couple of hundred years going on from the Mishnah to the Gemara. So sometimes the Mishnah will say a din, and there'll be a pasuk quoted, and the Gemara will say, what's with the pasuk? I thought this is a din d'rabbanan. And then the Gemara will ultimately conclude, yeah, it's an asmachta. It's not really the din d'rabbanan. So how could there be confusion about this? According to the Rambam, were the Tanoim all over on Baal Tosef? That basically they taught it then and people didn't understand that it was really Drabana? And it was only hundreds of years later that the Gemara clarifies that it's an Asmachta? So for a few hundred years, the people were fooled and they were in violation of Baal Tosef? Is that a problem? So I saw one contemporary sefer had a fascinating approach based on a Chassam Sofer. So the Chassam Sofer and his Chidushim to Masachas Gittin. Where he says that when the Tanoim, when Rabbi Nasi wrote down the Mishnayos, so even though that was the concession to write down the Torah Shabbal Peh, but even that was limited. So we have a minimum of what could be written down. But when it was taught still largely orally. So the Tanoim, when they taught these points that are written down in the Mishnayos, you could tell from the way they were teaching it more than the actual words. So it was clear to the students of the Tanoim what they were teaching, whether it was Daraisa or Darabanan. Later on, reading these Mishnayos, it's not necessarily so clear. So then the Gemara has to figure out, okay, is it Asmachtas, then Daraisa, then Darabanan. But in the interim time, it wasn't necessarily unclear. Hi.
There seems to be certain instances where their goal was to make you think it was Daraisa.
So there is an interesting question. What exactly do you mean by Asmachta? And it's a conversation that's worth having. I'm going to push it off for now because I want to get to some other points. So for now, I'm working off the view that Asmachta is just meant to be kind of a mnemonic tool. It is not at all the only view. The Ritva, for example, thinks that's a heretical view. But so it's a worthwhile discussion to have a little bit more about what Asmachta is. I'm pushing it off for now. So for now, just for simplicity's sake, let's assume that it's just a drop on it, but it's not at all a complete presentation of that topic. Okay. So that's one approach to this whole Kach Tiknu thing. That's because of Baltosif. Now there's another approach which is particularly important for us this week with the whole Kazera issue. So and this approach may also end up being a bridge between the Rambam and the Ramban. And may become a bridge to other approaches within this whole topic. It could be as follows. It could be that the reason there is a policy of Safek Daraisa L'Chumra by Din Daraisa and a Safek Darabanan L'Kula by Din Darabanan, and they may set it up that way on purpose, is that maybe there's an assumption here that there's a fundamental difference between rabbinic law and Torah law. That maybe Torah law represents actualities, spiritual realities. The Torah prohibited chazer. Chazer is spiritually bad. The Torah prohibited, another good example. I'm trying to find an example that's uncontroversial. It's always hard. The Torah prohibited Avodah Zarah. Yeah, okay. Avodah Zarah is inherently bad. Yeah, that's pretty uncontroversial. So something that's Asur Min HaTorah unequivocally, that's inherently bad. The role of rabbinic legislation, for the most part, is a safeguard. And a safeguard is not inherently bad. It's there to keep you away from something else. So then you might understand that essentially, why do I have to worry about a suffix? I have to worry about a suffix because maybe it's the bad thing that I'm worried about. And I'm just not sure. So let's say, for example, we spoke about this a little bit last semester when we talked about Behemten Shel Tzadikim. Right, let's say if I'm worried about poison. So if I think an item might have poison in it and it might kill me, so then even if I'm not sure that it has poison, so then I should probably avoid it, because if it may have poison and kill me, then I'm going to want to stay away from it. So when it comes to Torah law, if you assume that it's inherently real, so then you're going to want to worry about the stakos as well. But if you assume when it comes to rabbinic law that rabbinic law is about protecting Torah law, So then there's nothing inherently bad about whatever rabbinic prohibition it is. It's just there to keep you away from the inherently bad thing. So let's say in the case of our sugyas here, basr b'chalav is the inherently bad thing. Beef and milk is what is inherently spiritually harmful to you. Chicken and milk is meant to keep you away from that. So as a fence, maybe it's sufficient to just use the definite circumstances as a fence. You don't need the unknown circumstances also to be included in the fence. Let's give maybe a clearer example. Let's say if you were to compare Bishul Akum to Chazer. Now let's say we're to say that Chazer is inherently bad, and Bishul Akum, food that was cooked by an idolater, is bad because it could lead you to intermarry with an idolater. So, let's, again, for purposes of simplicity, let's say that's what it's about. So, if, when it comes to Chazer, because it's inherently bad, if it might be Chazer, we should stay away from it. But when it comes to the Bishul Akum, maybe it's enough to keep you away from intermarriage, it's enough just to stay away from that which you know is Bishul Akum. That which might be, but you don't even know, maybe that's already not particularly relevant to keeping you away from the actual danger. So that's another approach for the kach tiknu kind of school of thought. That's basically saying there's just a fundamentally different goal for Daraisas and Rabbanans. That distinction is going to be very relevant for us, and that's something to keep in mind greatly as we progress this week and talk about the Xeris as the Gemara is talking about. Maury.
So can you say that Dine Darabanan are, I mean, still Midaraisa? We have definitely instances of Siag Minatora.
Okay, so that's something which again is going to come up. I think it's part of why it's going to be super relevant to our sugya. Now, what Maury is asking, and we'll say more about this tomorrow because it's going to be part of our Gemara itself, but we saw a hint of, and I'm going to just say one sentence about it, and we'll say more about it back in the Gemara tomorrow, is that maybe that distinction that we just mentioned is not so absolute. And that even if it's generally true, but maybe there are exceptions. Maybe when it comes to some circumstances, there might be Torah laws that function like rabbinic laws, and maybe the other way around also. But that's the first, starting with the rule, is relevant to understanding the exceptions to the rule. So those are a few ways to, even just within the one answer of Kach Tiknu, what Meir was saying is built in, those are two ways to say why it's built in. Now, another way to explain it is to look at it this way, and this is how the Meshech Chachma, for example, expresses it. Meshech Chachma was written by the author of the Or Sameach, which is important to be aware of. The Or Sameach, Reb Meir Simcha Cohen of Dvinsk, who lived and died about 100 years ago. The Meshech Chachma in the Sefer on Chumash gives the following comparison. I'm going to adapt it a little bit. That it could be that even what the Rambam means is, it's not, the Rambam is not telling you that just because there's an existence of Lo Sasser and that that puts all of rabbinic legislation under a Torah commandment, that doesn't make mitzvos derabanan into mitzvos deraisa. And mashal mahadavar domen, if you think about the mashal this way, you know, I'm tweaking it a little bit, but it is pretty understandable if you think about it this way. So all of us have gone to school. So we know in school you have teachers and you have a principal who controls the school and who hires the teachers. So the teachers have authority in the classroom because the principal backs up their authority. And if a student were to say to a teacher, you can't tell me what to do, so ultimately they're going to have to deal with the principal. But we all understand that there's a difference between the principal and the teacher. Right? That it doesn't mean that whatever the teacher says, it's the same thing as the principal saying it. The principal backs up the authority of the teacher, so the teacher has authority because the principal said so. But there's clearly a hierarchy there. So too, when it comes to rabbinic law, you have to listen to rabbinic law because the Torah says to listen to the rabbis. But it doesn't mean that the rabbis are the same as God. It means that ultimately you'll have to answer to God if you defy the rabbis. But clearly there's a difference between the two. And if you think about it through the parameters of a teacher-principal kind of structure, it doesn't seem so hard to understand. And the Meshech Chachma talks about a king and a prince. But it's a hierarchy we're presumably familiar with. So it's understandable to say that's what's going on here also. That essentially the Torah imposes a prohibition to rebel against the authority of the rabbis. And in fact, some of the Achronim formulate it this way. Let's say somebody were to eat a chicken cheeseburger. Would that be a violation of Lo Sasser, of an Eser Daraisa? So some suggest it actually depends. That if they recognize that there's an Issa Darabanan to eat a chicken cheeseburger, but they are overcome by desire for one, and they can't control it, okay, so that's a violation of an Issa Darabanan. If their attitude is they're eating a chicken cheeseburger because there's no authority over them, the rabbis aren't the boss of them, so then that's a violation of an Issa D'Raisa. But the violation of the Issa D'Raisa is the rebellion, not the eating of the chicken cheeseburger. So that's an important conceptual distinction to appreciate also. Now just to be comprehensive, there are some who understand like that's the Rambam's position to avoid this whole problem of why is there a distinction. And there are them who say that's really what the Ramban is getting at, and that's how the Ramban differs from the Ramban. Okay, but one way or another, whether you associate it with the Rambam or the Ramban, that's probably a reasonable way to approach this topic, that there is a general authority that comes from the Torah, and the specifics, so that is within rabbinic legislation. So the general Torah idea is not to rebel against rabbinic authority. Now that is what has led to the position, or it may lead to the position associated with the Nesivos HaMishpat, which you mentioned a little bit last semester also. That also matches what we just said a few minutes ago. Right? The idea that Torah prohibitions are inherent and rabbinic prohibitions are not inherent, there's another way to come to that conclusion. Right? So a minute ago we said they're inherent because the Torah made them, and the rabbinic prohibitions are not inherent because they're just safeguards. There's another way to come to that conclusion. Maybe rabbinic prohibitions are not inherent because the rabbis can't make them inherent. The rabbis don't necessarily have any authority over objects. So Chazer is bad because the Torah said Chazer is bad and God wrote the Torah and God invented Chazer. But a chicken cheeseburger was neutral before the rabbis came and prohibited it. So what happened after they prohibited it? Did it become bad? So many would argue that no, a chicken cheeseburger is neutral, but we are prohibited to eat it. Now, why would you say that? Well, you could say that because it's just a safeguard, because there isn't anything inherently bad about it. But you could also say that it's neutral because the rabbis don't have the ability to change the nature of chicken cheeseburgers. You follow the point? That maybe the nature of rabbinic authority is that the Torah tells us we are not allowed to rebel against the commandments of the Torah. But that doesn't change reality in the world. So I can't eat a chicken cheeseburger because the Torah tells me I'm not allowed to rebel against rabbinic instruction. But it was neutral before, it's neutral now. Does that make sense?
Could you also just say by definition, by the fact that the Torah didn't make this usher, it's not inherently problematic?
Well, so it certainly started off that way, right? So then the question is, did it change? So when the rabbis prohibited, did anything change? And so the argument here will be that no, how could it change? Just because the rabbis prohibited it, how did it become spiritually bad? If the whole nature of rabbinic authority is that we are not allowed to rebel against rabbinic authority, so then I'm not allowed to eat this chicken cheeseburger. But it didn't change. So therefore, it was neutral before, it should be neutral now. That's the position many Achronim have. Now, more question about that?
Is it possible that there's a shinoi in the Mahus of the Chatzah on a Derabbanan level, meaning maybe it doesn't become inherently bad now that Rabbanan are Aseret, but once they're Aseret, it becomes, there is something inherently bad on the Derabbanan level.
What does that mean?
Meaning that there is something inherently bad with it, but the thing that's inherently bad with it would be more B'toros Losas, or than it would be, like you said before, of a Nisr Derais of eating a chicken cheeseburger. That's not a thing.
You have to figure out if that makes any difference. You have to figure out if there's any practical ramifications that it has. It's a complex point. You have to figure out, like, except that the rabbis addressed it that way.
Meaning that it's possible that there is a shinoi in the most of the chafza, but it's not in a, not akadikach that it's as inherently bad as an Isser Daraisa.
So again, you have to figure out how that would make a difference.
It's possible, right?
If you can figure out how, because otherwise it's just a in the air a little bit. So if you assume that the rabbis don't have authority outside the instruction to Jews, right? Jews have to not rebel against the Torah. So that might mean that the object remains neutral. So this could affect a few other things. Just to clarify what the impact is of saying such a thing. Sorry?
To get that there on something which is,
well, you as an individual can take a nether.
That makes sense.
I'm saying you can't.
Already asked inside the chavza. I was talking about the
shvuah.
Right. Okay, that's getting very lumpish, but let's get more basic first. Okay, so what would it mean to say that rabbinic authority only comes from the idea that you have to listen to the Torah's instruction not to rebel, lo saser, but that's it. So what would the ramifications be? So it may have a few other ramifications. For example, you know, we say that children are obligated in mitzvos midrabbanan. Right? Normally, below bar bas mitzvah, say children aren't obligated in mitzvos. But because of chinuch, midrabbanan, children are obligated in mitzvos when they're ready. So there are some rishonim who address the question, either directly or indirectly, how could children be obligated in mitzvos at all? Even midrabbanan. In order to be obligated in mitzvah derabbanan, you have to be subject to the authority of lo saser. If you're not chayiv in mitzvos, then you're not chayiv in lo saser either. So then maybe you can't be chayiv in mitzvos at all. Meir? So that's how some of the Rishonim explain. That's what I'm saying. So some of the Rishonim address this that way, that if you say that the mitzvah is on the father, that's the way to get around this concern. Because it might be a problem if you say that mitzvahs derabbanan only exist because of lo saser, so then if you're not subject to lo saser, it's not clear how you could be chayiv at all. That's one issue. There is a major discussion in Achronim. We know that sometimes Chazal add on to a mitzvah min HaTorah. Like, for example, benching is a mitzvah min HaTorah, but Chazal have expanded it to include four brachos. Kiddush is a mitzvah min HaTorah, but Chazal have expanded it to require a cup of wine and a makom suda, etc., etc. So what would happen if somebody would fulfill the mitzvah only in the Torah form? Would they still fulfill the mitzvah? Or, let's ask the question a different way. There's a mitzvah in our Torah to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, no matter what day of the week it is. But the rabbis prohibited blowing shofar on Shabbos. And the Talmud tells us that that's included within their authority. So there was a major discussion in the Achronim. What would happen if I would blow shofar on Shabbos? Or I would take lulav on Shabbos if it was the first day of Sukkot? I'm not supposed to do that. But am I at least in fulfillment of the mitzvah? Or do we say that, no, Chazal uprooted the mitzvah is no longer there? When they made their enactment, so two different types of questions. When they prohibited blowing shofar on Shabbos or taking lulav on Shabbos, did they cancel the mitzvah? Or, let's say, in the softer version of kiddush and benching, they didn't prohibit something, they just told us to do it better. Did they erase the earlier version of the mitzvah? Can they do that, Levi?
Are we talking about lulav on the first day of Sukkot or lulav on the rest of the days of Sukkot? Because that's also
first day. This is the first
day. First day, when we know it's been a Torah.
Right. So can they? So we do know that they are allowed to stop you from doing that mitzvah. But can they also cancel it? So this was a big fight in the Achron. So I would think, and I'm now skirting around a huge literature to make this point, but I would think that it would be consistent with this point that if one assumes that the rabbis only have authority because the Torah says we have to listen to them, so then it would mean we're not allowed to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. We're not allowed to take a lulav. We're not allowed to decide not to bench fully or take blow shofar or make kiddush fully. But the mitzvah doesn't fundamentally change. The mitzvah is still there. You could raise some interesting questions maybe about mitzvah habah bi'avera with a mitzvah derabbanan, with an avera derabbanan. But it would seem like the rabbis cannot change the definition of a mitzvah. That's what it would seem like. It would sound like these three topics all correlate. That if you believe that the whole source of rabbinic authority is because of Los Osir. So then it means that Jews are obligated not to rebel against what the rabbis say, and therefore we cannot eat the chicken cheeseburger, but it is essentially spiritually neutral. It would mean that children are not obligated themselves in mitzvahs on any level. And it would mean that, or at least unless you could explain it in some different way, which maybe you can. And it would mean that when the rabbis oppose a mitzvah min haTorah, they're just telling you not to perform it, but the mitzvah still stays that way. However, there is a different approach. Rav Yosef Engel, who we've mentioned a few times, Rav Yosef Engel in his Sefer Asvin D'Araisa, I think we mentioned this a little bit last semester, Rav Yosef Engel brings some midrashic statements and Talmudic statements to assert that when it comes to rabbinic legislation, God signs on. God endorses the rabbinic legislation. And it does change. So essentially, he agrees to it. And therefore, it could take on a new character. So that, theoretically, could allow for different approaches on all of these issues. And for there to be a machlokas on these points. So, there's a lot more to say about this. We're just trying to give some of the broad strokes. So, that's as far as mostly as far as the Rambam is concerned. As I said, there are some who understand the Ramban like this, that the Ramban sees Los Osir as being relevant, but just differently than the Rambam, that he sees it more as an umbrella authority rather than as a direct authority. It's a little difficult because it sounds more like that's really what the Rambam means than the Ramban is arguing. So what are some other possibilities for the Ramban? If the Ramban doesn't like Los Osir as the source, so what else is possible? So part of the problem you see here is that it's not just that he's going to have to reject this pasuk from his questions. He'd have to reject any pasuk, right? Because any pasuk would pose the same issues. So it's not just Los Osir, even though that had the whole contextual question, but even if we could find a different pasuk, so you'd have the same problems about how could you distinguish Safek Deraisa, etc. So any pasuk is going to pose a problem. Yes, sir?
If the Ramban wouldn't understand that it's coming from a pasuk, he would understand it's coming from a svara.
So then can you say it's from a svara?
Run into the issue of the Rebbe Chanan. I think we mentioned that Rebbe Chanan.
Yes, Rebbe Chanan makes... Yeah, so you're not going to run into this issue. Rebbe Chanan says this. Right? So Rebbe Chanan, I mean, it's here in this context. So Rebbe Chanan says that... So basically what Mori is saying both halves of is that if it's not a pasuk, maybe it's a svar. Maybe it's logically compelling. So Rebbe Chanan Wasserman, in his essays about Dinam Durabanan, called Kuntres Divrei Sofrim, Rebbe Chanan considers and rejects that. Because, he says... A svara, the Gemara says in a few places that a svara seems to have the authority of a din min haTorah. So if you want to say that it's a svara, it's logically compelling without a pasuk, he assumes that you're going to run into all the same problems. Sorry?
Yeah, but the flip side of it, if it's not a svara or a pasuk, then you could say that the rabbis are only giving themselves power.
Right, so then we're really in trouble, right? So what is going to be the source going to be? So there are a few other possibilities. You have to wonder if that really is such a rock-solid point. You know, could still be differences between a svara and a pasuk. But, you know, there could be other ways around that. But there are a few other possible approaches. Some consider the possibility that maybe it's kind of a communal neder, that we take upon ourselves to obey whatever specific din derabanan, which has its pluses and minuses. You know, Ron's like, maybe it could be. One appeal to it is we know that Chazal do say that not every gezeira took, right? If a gezeira wasn't something that was accepted by the rabbin, then it didn't actually take place, which kind of sounds like maybe there is a certain degree of communal acceptance which is necessary. Others found problems with that, and the tshuva about it, and the tshuva sisaris tshuva, various difficulties that are raised to that possibility. What Rabbi Chanan himself basically feels is the case is that this is an expression of avas Hashem, which is similar to the svar idea, but I guess in the less absolute way that he felt to be problematic, that essentially we are taught through Chazal as to what it is that God likes beyond what he actually commands. That if you can read what is between the lines of the Torah, so then you realize that there's more that is actually desired, and that once Chazal clue us into what that is, so then it becomes our responsibility to observe that as well. And that becomes a focus of that. So that's an interesting idea. And if you think about that, it also becomes relevant that there probably are two different types of dinim derabanan. And this becomes particularly true in Hilchos Shabbos, but it's true everywhere, that there are activities which are similar enough to what the Torah commands or prohibits that we should understand that that's also either a bad idea or a good idea, depending on what we're talking about. And Chazal are pointing us in that direction. Or there are things that are not necessarily inherently similar enough, but they are practically similar enough, so we have to worry that they're risky. So that's where you get to the concern of a gezeira. So that means that there are, let's say, two types of dinim derabanan. There are things that are prohibited because by their nature they are similar to things the Torah prohibited, and therefore they are bad, just like the bad things the Torah told us not to do. And there are things that are maybe not so bad, but they're too similar to things the Torah prohibited that there's a danger if we do them, we may end up doing what the Torah prohibited. And on the good side, there are things that are, we probably only have one category, that there are things that are similar to things the Torah commanded, so therefore it would make sense for us to do that. Now, when it comes to a siag, so I included this on today's source list, that there is a pasuk in the end of Parshas Achrimos, which is particularly relevant, that the Torah says, "Ushmartem es mishmarti." You should protect my mishmeres. This is going to be very important for this week's topic, so keep this in mind. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to say a few more words and then review, so we make sure we're on top of everything, especially that which is relevant for this week's sugya. Maybe next Sunday we'll fill in a little bit more just to keep us on top of some of these important points.
Yeah. Tomorrow is back to the...
Right, tomorrow we'll be back inside the Gemara. Back in the...
Back to Basar Chal?
Yeah. But it's going to all connect right away because you see what we thought we where we left off. When I finish, I'll see how we'll connect back in. So essentially, the Torah tells us you should protect my mishmeres. So the Gemara says in Maseches Yevamos in the second parak, asu mishmeres l'mishmarti. You should make a safeguard for my prohibitions. So this gives us an instruction to protect the Torah's prohibitions. Essentially, what's formulated in the first mission in Pirkei Avos, Esu Siag LaTorah, you should make a safeguard for the Torah. So what's the relationship between this and Lo Sasur? So there is some discussion about this. I'm just going to tell you the way which I think is most simple and straightforward. And I think that they are addressing two different things which complement each other. Ushmartim is Mishmarti is telling us that there is a value and an imperative to protecting the Torah's rules. And that we shouldn't just skate right up to the border, but that we have to take the initiative to protect the Torah. And this may vary depending on who we're talking to. And in fact, the Mesilas Yesharim, the classic Musar text, writes that this is not just an instruction to all of Klal Yisrael. This is true to every individual. The average person finds it possible to walk through Washington Heights and walk past McDonald's and not feel like he has to go in and eat at the McDonald's. But let's say you don't feel that way. And we don't have a rule that no Jew can walk past McDonald's. But let's say your experience has been that every time you walk past McDonald's, you see two burgers, fries, a Coke, and a free helicopter at 64 cents, and you feel like you just have to go in there. So you have to make a rule for yourself, says the Mesilas Yesharim, that you should not walk that way. You should walk around. So the rule of Asu Mishmeres U'Mishmarti applies on many different levels. And for every individual, he should take whatever safeguards are necessary. Now, there are some things which are a common enough concern that it's not just for individuals, but Klal Yisrael as a whole has to worry. Doesn't mean everybody, but it means that there's enough of a percentage in Klal Yisrael that there's a risk for the tzibur. So the rabbis, in their role as guardians of the tzibur, they should make a policy that everyone should stay away. Like, for example, say, Fishalakum or whatever it is, there are certain things which they perceive are a problem for enough of the population, pose a risk for enough of the population, that they should make a rule for the Tzibor as a whole, for Klal Yisrael as a whole. So, Asu Mishmeres U'Mishmarti is saying to everyone on their own level, protect the Torah, whether it's an individual who is got unique concerns that he should worry about, or whether it's Klal Yisrael, the rabbis acting on behalf of Klal Yisrael, how they should protect the entire tzibur. Now you might say, okay, but if it's just me, so I can tell myself what to do. Who empowers the rabbis to tell Klal Yisrael what to do? Where does their authority to do that come from? So the answer might be from Lo Sasur. So the two psukim are addressing different halves of this equation. That Lo Sasur is what gives them the power to make the rules. And the motivation comes from Mishmartim is Mishmartim. The directive, the instruction to do so in cases of spiritual risk, comes from Mishmartim is Mishmartim. So that is going to be very important to understanding some of the parameters that are going to be relevant for some of the sugyas this week. and we will soon see how that impacts. Now, I should just mention those who are learning Daf Yomi, so it's also interesting because Asumishmaris from Mishmarti may give license but may have limited license. So how does that impact Maseches Brachos? So we'll, God willing, have an opportunity to say a little bit about that this week also. So I just want to recap some of the important points. We said a lot, so let's recap some of the important points. And again, try to appreciate and to keep in mind that this will very much affect our ability to have a good context for the sugyas that are coming up this week. So what did we discuss? So we tried to figure out, how do the rabbis have authority to tell us what to do? And we saw that the Rambam was of the opinion that it comes from Lo Sasser, which this in Parashat Shoftim, where the Torah tells us we should turn to rabbinic authorities if we don't know how to follow the Torah, we have to listen. And the Rambam says, not only do we have to listen about how to interpret the Torah, we have to listen when they make new rules also. The Ramban says, really, we have to listen to the new rules. First of all we see from the Pesukim here is judiciary authority, not legislative authority. But also, who says that they can make new rules? That would mean it's all Torah law, and we know that we differentiate between Torah law and rabbinic law, most well known through the rule of Safek Drabanan Lekula. When it comes to Torah law, we have to be machmir. And there are a few Gemaras that are also relevant, the Gemara in Brachos about Kavod Abrios and Kombos Drabanan, and the Gemara in Shabbos about the Bracha on Hanukkah candles and the like. But these were the fundamental questions. So we discussed a few approaches. Essentially, why should the Rambam say it's all from Lo Sasser and still allow distinctions? So one approach was to say that they set it up this way on purpose, kaf tikva. So why would they do that? So we mentioned two general reasons. One is to avoid Baal Tosef, that maybe there has to be a distinction between Torah law and rabbinic law to avoid Baal Tosef. And we talked about that and whether that's really true or not. The Rambam thought it wasn't true. And some interesting considerations about that. And the other possibility was because there's a fundamental difference between the purpose of rabbinic law and Torah law. And therefore, that itself accounts for it, that rabbinic law is there to protect Torah law. Torah law is inherent. So if it's there to protect Torah law, it's enough that we only deal with definite circumstances. We don't need to deal with indeterminate circumstances also. And that's a possibility. And then we talked about another approach that maybe like the Meshech Chachma says, it doesn't mean that everything is in the Torah itself. It's essentially umbrella authority, like a principal and a teacher, like a king and a prince. We can understand that even if one's backing up the other, that there's still a difference between the two, and there are some who see that within the Ramban. So we talked about looking at it like this, that if we say that essentially that the Torah is telling you you're not allowed to rebel against rabbinic authority, and that's where rabbinic authority comes from, that could have some important ramifications. It could mean that by its very nature, rabbinic law is never going to be inherent, it's only going to be an instruction to the individual. So the chicken cheeseburger that we'll learn about this week is going to be neutral, always, because the rabbis not just would make it that way because of the safeguard, but also because they inherently don't have the authority to change an object. They only have the authority to tell you how to relate to an object. And maybe also the idea of a katan being obligated in mitzvos has to mean that the father is obligated to train the child in mitzvos, because children are not subject to Lo Sasser, so they can't be chayiv in drabbanan. And when the rabbis say don't blow shofar on Shabbos, they would have to mean that the mitzvah is still there, just they tell you not to blow the shofar, but they have no control over the parameters of the mitzvah. That would all probably be consistent with saying that Lo Sasser is the whole story. However, mentioned that Rav Yosef Engel understood it differently. Rav Yosef Engel said that God signs on to whatever the rabbis legislate, and therefore there could be more to it. So maybe it could take on a inherent identity, or maybe the mitzvah would change, maybe there would be no more mitzvah shofar on Shabbos, etc., etc. And then we started to consider also what could be some other approaches if you don't like the Rambam, because you feel it can't be a pasuk like the Ramban.
So what else could it be? So he mentioned some understand the Rambam, but he does, the Ramban, but he does think it's Losasar, but it's umbrella authority. Some understand that it's a Svara, but like Rabbi Chanan said, if it's a Svara, you're going to run into all the same problems. Some understand that it's a Neder, which has some appeal, but also has some other problems. And Rabbi Chanan himself basically sees it as an expression of Avas Hashem, that when you have a sense of what it is that he wants, so then you will follow that. And we talked about the Gemara and the Rambam based on the Pasuk in Acharnos of Shmarti Mishmarti, Yisum Shmar, Yisum Shmarti, a directive there to protect the Torah. And we discussed how does it relate to L'Sosar and Shmarti Mishmarti, and we explained that really there are two halves of the equation, that L'Sosar is the authority, and Yisum Shmar, Yisum Shmarti is the tzivoy to do so, is the commandment to protect the Torah, and therefore we find that there's a value to do this both on the individual level and on the communal level. On the communal level, how do you know that the rabbis can speak on behalf of the community and instruct them? That's because of Lo Sasser. Now, the distinction that we said, the general distinction, that Torah law is more inherent and rabbinic law is more protective. So what we started to say is that that's generally the case, but it's not absolute, because as Rav Svengel in his other essay in Lekach Tov taught us, there may be a few examples of Torah law which is really there for protective purposes, possibly. And one example might be Bishul Basar B'Chalav, and we're going to further consider that issue when we pick up tomorrow. Okay, I wish everyone a wonderful day. It should be only good things.